courtesy of the Women's Board, San Francisco Museum of Art, Victor De Souvero and George Walker.
Victor De Souvero.
De Souvero. Yes, and George Walker.
Mark De Souvero's brother, Mark the sculptor.
Right.
Victor the poet.
Yes, and publicity by Laurie Bunker of Consultants Incorporated. And it says underneath, much thanks is due to the entire museum staff, Julius Wasserstein. Is that Wendy Wasserstein's relative? You know, the playwright. Julius Wasserstein.
I knew Wendy, but it never occurred to me that they might have been related.
Right, and the initial encouragement of the museum's director, George Culler, that's who you went and saw originally, right? George Culler. It says, these performances are experiments in the effects of simultaneous communications. We would be grateful for any observations, impressions, and critique. Please address such to Gerd Stern in care of the San Francisco Museum. Now, you know, the effects of simultaneous communications. I don't think people back then were aware that television and radio were simultaneous. They lived it, but couldn't articulate it like McLuhan did. And you have a, you want to comment on that before I read a quote from McLuhan?
No, go ahead, read the quote.
It says, in the electronic age, whose media substitute all at onceness for one thing at a timeness, the movement of information at approximately the speed of light has become by far the largest industry in the world. Patterns of human association based on slower media have become overnight not only irrelevant and obsolete, but a threat to continued existence and sanity. you're saying, yes, our nonlinear presentation is a lot more relevant.
my phraseology for it was, in a world of simultaneous operations, you don't have to be first to be on top.
And just to mention, you do have listed, it says, conceived and produced by poet Gerd Stern and associated with painter Ivan Majdrikov, sociologist Howard Becker, and the San Francisco Tate Music Center. Judy McBean, coordinator. There's her name. So Howard was part of the thinking before it was shown, before it was presented?
He was in charge of the, of the sociology panel. So, yeah, he was part. He's still a friend of mine.
Right. It's not that you invited him over and he came over. You had to talk to him beforehand and get him interested.
Yes, and to get him working on the concept. Yeah.
Okay, so here's this. The simultaneous world we live in, which is a norm now, everybody knows it. They may not think of the, they don't, may not know how it applies to the crash of Wall Street or anything like that, but they, it's very cliche, this awareness now. But when you presented 40 years ago, here's what the reaction was. Alfred Frankenstein, he says, after the title, a landmark of a flop. I mean, this was a major flop, Kurt. This ain't a puny flop. This is a major one.
Well, I think I told you that when I saw that review, I felt like Stravinsky after the Rites of Spring.
Right, right. You had done something. You knew you had made it. You were a success. He goes, quoting, some colossal flops have taken place in the public halls of San Francisco in my time, but Gerd Stern's show called Who Are You and What's Happening is the only one I can recall that laid so vast and horrendous an egg as to score a kind of success. Even he knew that there was some other level of success in there, right? He says, at least those who attended his first presentation last night at the San Francisco Museum and Art are not likely to forget it in a hurry. Now, I would say they probably did, because so much other stuff started happening in the media environment pretty quickly in life generally. The Kennedy assassination wiped this out a week later, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't know that so much would happen in the media environment once you're into the 60s, right? So there's a very naive point right there. Are not likely to forget it in a hurry. Well, they did, I would say. It is announced, he says, it is announced, God save us, to be done again tomorrow night at the same place. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, the guy's warning people, this is going to be done again.
and as a result, Stanley Grubel.
Yes, I mean, that is Stravinsky. Did Stravinsky have another performance after the riot night?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Okay.
The second night, I took acid.
Yeah, not the first night.
No.
Because, well, why did you? Just to ignore the effects, or you just figured it's going
to
be great?
No, I wanted to experience it, you know, in a different state of mind.
Yeah, you wanted to experience the effects of simultaneous communication squared. You wanted to square the process.
Yeah.
Stern never provided a clear statement of his intentions, and it's difficult to describe what went on. As one arrived, a lovely child named Allison Becker, and they have her picture, but she doesn't look that young. She should have glasses on or something. Like, how old is she actually? She's just 10?
At that time, maybe 12.
Okay, maybe it was a blurred picture. It's hard to tell. A lovely child named Allison Becker, dressed like a stop-and-go signal. Oh, I see what that is, yeah. Handed out a kind of non-program on which one read the motto of the evening's doings, quoted from Marshall McLuhan. And then he quotes the whole thing that we just read,
yeah.
You know, a threat to continued existence and sanity. Then it says, in keeping with this philosophy, in McLuhan's philosophy, some 7 television sets were placed on the stage of the museum's central court, and they ran all evening on different programs silently. 3 screens were erected for the simultaneous projection of slides. Now, this is before ESCO. I mean, the ESCO guys don't even know this is happening, right?
No.
They don't know, and they're going to...
What do you mean, the ESCO guys? There was no ESCO, so...
Yeah.
I was friends with Steve back east, and I had just met Michael.
Right, but so they don't... This is going to be the pattern that ESCO is going to build on, but...
That's right.
And they don't know this. But they heard about this, right? They heard all about this, and then they were interested immediately because of the flop aspects, or...
No, I don't think they...
I mean Steve Durkee, mainly.
He heard about it peripherally, but it wasn't until I went back east, which was not that long thereafter, that he really became involved.
Right.
We were friends.
Although, yeah, you were friends. And you hadn't maybe talked to him much about what you were going to do that night.
No.
So you actually did create the archetype, the mold for ESCO. I mean, you and Michael did. But you were the one
that came up. And also, the reason I created it, as I told you before, had to do with Kumaraswamy, which I had gotten from Grace Clements during the KPFA days.
Right. And what had he said?
He talked about the artist in traditional societies, who was not a special person, but just like everybody else, somebody who did what they did, you know, so that nobody signed anything and so forth and so on. And I thought, hey, that was a great model.
That's what you were thinking when you created this event?
No, when I created ESCO.
Ah, but that's later. That's the thinking behind how you would work together.
Yes, yeah. Instead of, you know, I mean, it was easy when it was just Steve and I.
Well, you belong to you guys should be members of a group Carol and I formed 40 years ago called Unknowns Anonymous. You guys were working on the problems of becoming that at that time.
That's right.
Yeah.
We definitely were.
Okay.
But it was, you know, I mean, Steve was at that time a painter, and he was showing under the name Steve Durkee. And, you know, my first show at Allen Stone and the show at the museum was Gerd Stern. But then when the three of us plus more people started working together, it occurred to me that that's what Kumaraswamy had written about, and you know, the company of us sounded like a very good way to go about including everybody.
Right. Now, McLuhan is writing in Gutenberg Galaxy in 62 about the role of the anonymous artist in medieval history and before in tribal societies. I don't know if you would have read that in the report, that aspect.
I think I read that in the report, and I linked it to Kumaraswamy, and as a matter of fact, much later, I asked Marshall, I think in Vancouver, whether he knew of Kumaraswamy, and of course he did.
Okay, so the thing is, though, McLuhan would say, if you have an electronic environment, everybody goes corporate, anonymous, and it's teamwork and no more literate individualism, which is what happens under print conditions. So that when you moved into this medium, you immediately had to be anonymous. McLuhan would say, well, immediately you would think of being anonymous and have a group because the medium dictated that. Do you know what I mean? The medium you were working with.
Well, I get the picture. Yeah.
Maybe we went through this, you know, hours ago. I can't remember what made you want to put this mixed media thing on as yourself when you presented George Kohler. Why did you want to do it? What was inspiring you? Was it try to put in place McLuhan, whatever McLuhan inspired in you?
No, wait a minute. It grew like Topsy. I went to George Kohler with this drawing of Contact is the Only Love, big 7-foot drawing, which I unfolded. I mean, it was highly colored, and I said I wanted to build it, and I showed him some of the pieces that I had in New York at Allen Stone, and he said that he'd be interested in showing it. And I said, well, the problem was I had to I didn't have the money to build it. And he said, well, he didn't have any money, but he would give us the tax cut, you know, the tax-exempt coverage of the museum.
He said, give and you, not us, give you. It was only you he was talking to.
Yes. Give me. Okay, so, and then he said, and you're a poet, why don't you have a poet reading in our auditorium? We have a big auditorium, and you can raise some money that way. And I said to him, hey, it's very nice of you, but I don't think me reading poetry is going to raise very much money. I'd been to various poetry readings at the museum, actually. In fact, the first day I ever came to California, I went to hear Philip LaMantia, who I didn't know at the time, and Brother Antonius.
Right, that's the first time you came out.
It wasn't his name yet.
But that was the first time you came to California.
Yeah, so that wasn't the same time, yeah. Anyway,
he said, well, what are you going to do?
Well, if you can have the auditorium for two nights. So I left. And I started thinking, what can we do? And
what can you do? It's still just you.
Yeah, well, I mean, what can I do? Yes. Well, if obviously, I got this idea of doing something, and it kept expanding and expanding, and I couldn't do it by myself, but first I talked to Yvonne and to Stuart Brand. Yes. Well, Yvonne and Stuart took the photos that we used for the Verbal American Landscape, which is what we showed there.
Yvonne Mazurkoff. Yeah.
Yes.
But what is the first idea? What you say? You know why? We know what happened, but what was the first thing that you thought of doing that wouldn't be a poetry reading?
I was thinking of the Verbal American Landscape, the slideshow, the three screen slideshow, and then
which you had already done, or is that?
No. We worked on it for that night, but I got that started, and then.
Yeah, but how did you get that started? Maybe it's in the earlier sessions, but I can't remember.
I got to go out and take photographs of words that I could use.
That's what you did after you got the notion at this time.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the first idea. It was
the Verbal American. Okay, so that's the thing. It says, yeah, these performances are studies toward a larger multimedia presentation, the Verbal American Landscape, but it began with the Verbal American Landscape.
Yes, and then I decided I wanted to add sound to it, and of course, I wasn't in a position to acquire the sound, and I decided that that it would have to be live. So the whole idea, and then I started talking to Howie Becker about, you know, how to kind of expand this. And
why are you wanting to expand it?
Well, because I thought we needed something fairly dramatic to make money.
To get attention.
To get the audience. You know?
Yeah.
And it just kept growing. It took months.
Conversations with Stewart, with Yvonne,
And in the meantime, we were building Contact Is the Only Love on the slopes of Mount Tamalpais.
You said moving
and
it?
And then Michael McClure was somebody I talked to about it a lot, too.
What do you mean you were moving Contact Is the Only High?
No, we were building.
Oh, you actually were building it?
Yes.
Because you need, that's the real reason. You want to have a presentation, get some money, and then put that big thing you're building.
He promised me a one-person show, which I had not had before. And he said he would pay for the shipping of the pieces that had been shown in New York, which one of them was that very big over, 4 foot by 8 foot. Anyway, there was a whole truckload of stuff that came from New York. And we had a one-man show, and the two nights of...
No, wait a minute. When was the one-man show?
At the same time.
Same 2 days? November?
No, it was on for like a month.
But it started at the same time.
Yes, exactly.
But what's happening here is he's allowing you to have the show before you've raised the money, even though you're supposed to raise the money.
No. There were months between the meeting and the show. And there were months because we had to build contact. And in the meantime, I conceived and assembled all the elements for the show. So it was really months in between.
Right, but you still got to have the money to have the show.
I was raising the money. I went all over town asking people for money. And a number of people came through, especially a guy who I met at Kaiser. Hal Babbitt was the guy. He was a close associate of Henry J. Kaiser. Very lovely guy. And we became very good friends. I met him on a completely cold business call, and he got into it. And Kaiser eventually contributed a couple of $1,000s, and he contributed some hundreds of dollars personally, and that was kind of the major contribution. But there were three or four other people.
Right, but that's for the Contact Is the Only High show.
Love. No, that was to build contact.
Oh, is that what's the name of this?
We didn't need any money for who are you and what's happening.
I know, but you need money to put the show on, and you got this guy to help, and that's the show. And I'm looking here; it says in the page before, it says "Love to Come to a Real Destruction" at the Bella Union Theater.
Yeah, that was a completely different performance piece.
Nothing to do with contact or the happening
or
thing.
Or you know what's happening now.
Right, but what's interesting is that you're working towards the show, towards the contact show, getting money, that's okay,
but because
the guy said he'd give you some space, you're going to provide a different event for that, that's the Who Are You, and does the contact show ever happen?
Yes.
And what's the date of that?
The same date. It starts at the same time.
Is it in the same building?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So there's no reviews of that in the booklet.
Well, there are reviews of it, but isn't there a whole view of contact in there somewhere?
I don't see it immediately. Oh, we might come across it. But the point is that this secondary thing, for you, the most important thing is the contact is the only high. This
is the only love.
Is the only love.
There wasn't necessarily the most important, because as the show started taking dimension...
The Who Are You show.
And the title, you know, came to me. All of a sudden I was working with a about a dozen people.
So there were two parts of a show. The Contact is the Only Love,
and even Michael became involved because he figured out the sound, how to do the sound portion.
Right.
Of Contact.
So the two of them are under the title The Verbal American Landscape. That's the way you would, in a way, the verbal, or maybe just The Happening is The Verbal American Landscape. I don't know, maybe not The Contact.
Yeah, no, Contact had nothing to do with
okay.
it, really. It was a Gerd Stern exhibition at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
Okay, so going back to the Who Are You, and so the Who Are You is inspired by the Verbal American Landscape. What inspired?
It's inspired by McLuhan's report.
Oh, that's right, which you then call the Verbal American Landscape. When you were thinking of the Contact Zone High in New York, right?
No, I thought of it on the highway as we were driving from New York to California.
And the film you make of the signs and that on the highway, what's that called?
Why?
Why?
The letter Y.
Right. And that is not filmed on this trip going to San Francisco when you're thinking.
No. It's not filmed till
a year later?
Till afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. But when I see that film, I've seen it. It's sort of like the Verbal American Landscape, the concept.
Yes, it has the same kind of iconography.
Right. So it's another spin-off or version of the theme, the Verbal American Landscape, which is really what's in your mind, and that was inspired by McLuhan.
Yeah, now we're doing a German version.
Right now.
Right now. And I met with both the sound artist and the photographer when I was in Germany last week.
What, is it going to have a lot more technology or content?
Well, the technology is quite different because the original was three slide projectors, tape recorders. This time it's going to be three flat screens and a computer and speakers.
With the same original content?
Well, we're going to be able to show the same original content as well as the new German content.
Ah.
The German content is an analog of the U.S. content, but it's completely different because it's a different language.
Wow!
But it's the same kind of visual words taken off the present German landscape.
Right.
Mostly in Berlin.
And it's a lot easier, a lot more beautiful because you got the technology to do it.
No, I wouldn't say so. The display technology is going to be very different, and maybe you might call it easier. I mean, the original slide projectors, that was even pre-carousel, because there were no carousels in 1963. We had to use those projectors that you had to slide things, three slides across, in and out, in and out. It wasn't until USCO that we got carousels.
Okay, that's interesting. I think we got a clearer notion of the UR origins of this phenomenon that I'm reading a review of, or one part of this phenomenon. So he says, in keeping with this philosophy, some seven television sets were placed on the stage of the museum's central court, and they ran all evening on different programs silently. Three screens were erected for the simultaneous projection of slides. A vast turmoil of electronic sound equipment. A vast turmoil. That means wiring all over the place that is visible?
Well, I mean, it wasn't, to us, it wasn't a vast turmoil. It was a difficult technical assembly. In other words, you had four gazebos, each with a microphone in it, and each one had four people talking, so they had to pass the microphone around. Then we had, from the four sociologists, four telephone lines, closed circuit, that were between the sociologists and the people in the gazebo, right?
Right.
everything was supposed to be broadcast out to the audience. Plus, we had some tapes that we were playing.
Right. So he says here a vast turmoil of electronic sound equipment was on a table.
Yes,
it was on a table.
That was Michael's table. Yes.
And experts from the San Francisco Tape Center fussed over it all evening as if it wasn't working properly, which was and then he goes, which was probably true, which is what you were just saying, right? It's true. It wasn't working properly.
It was working, but there were, you know, technical things that we hadn't
anticipated.
Considered.
But see, he thinks...
Because the feedback was caused by the... that there were too many devices close to each other.
Yeah, which no one had really experienced before because they hadn't attempted this kind of collage of technology. So it was a discovery of feedback. And so he says the experts fussed over it all evening as if it wasn't working properly, which was probably true. He did not realize it wasn't working properly. He didn't get the feedback effect. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
He thinks that, these guys know what they're doing, but they kind of screwed up. But he didn't know the real message was that you alchemically created a whole new effect. I don't know if anybody ever experienced that before.
I mean, he was a classicist.
Yes, yeah, visually biased. I-Man. But could we say, is this the first time people heard feedback on that level? I mean, maybe they heard it in a recording studio occasionally, but... I don't know if you had as
publicly, probably, except in
industry.
In any kind of a meeting.
Yeah.
In the old days, you used to hear it, and then people would squelch it very quickly by moving the microphone or moving the speakers.
They knew how to handle it. It was mono.
Well, any sound technician knew what it was all about.
Right.
I mean, a positive feedback loop. Feedback loop is a classical phenomenon.
Right. So the
I didn't know what it was.
Right.
Michael had to explain it to me afterwards.
You had never experienced it.
No. I may have experienced it, but I certainly didn't know what it was.
So here's what's interesting: that quote we're giving from James Conner describing Finnegan's Wake is that Joyce is. It's slightly like feedback that he's putting on the printed page, and nobody had ever experienced it, and they didn't know what he was doing. But he was just taking the static and the squeals on the shortwave and putting it in the content, and people just weren't aware of sound and never thought of putting it in a book. See, that was the genius of Joyce, collaging in a new way, different environments. Then you were inspired by that through McLuhan.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, if you think about McLuhan's ideas of content and effect.
Yeah.
Here you have Joyce, who is simply translating context.
Content.
Content from one medium to another.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically a translator. He's not a creator.
No, he's just describing what is.
Yeah, and he's using the information to. In a different medium, which is his familiar medium.
Yeah.
But you don't understand. There's no way that anybody would have been able to trace it.
That's right. Nobody. He was presenting the new present, the invisible environment, in an old medium, and everybody looked at the old medium in old medium terms. He could not see the new content, the new present effect.
And a lot of people at that time didn't even. Relate to the new medium, right?
Yeah.
I mean, shortwave was, I don't know, I can't remember when it was developed.
That's right, I may could check the wiki on that, let me just continue here. But there's
something about the First World War.
Right, and the thing is that this principle of the invisible present that Joyce is doing in his artifact of the book is what becomes the sociological principle McLuhan develops. You know, he broadens the principle. So it continues here. The show started 45 minutes late. four groups of people sat around tables just talking. That, like, that wasn't enough. They were just talking. Two of these groups were apparently, in brackets apparently, in covered booths. See, he's not even sure. It was all invisible to him. Were apparently in covered booths on the stage, and the other two were in the large niches on either side of the room. Now, there's no chaos there, but he's experienced the feedback, and he thinks it's chaotic.
Yeah.
He's not even sure who was there, what was going on. He says, eventually the proceedings started. The lights were lowered and the slides came on three at a time. They were photographed by Ivan Madrikov, and many of them were quite beautiful. They were pictures of public words. So wooden the way he said. They were pictures of public words. I mean, speech is a public word. You know. And then he says, words on street signs, doors, traffic signals, trucks, and similar things. You getting this? You getting the humor of this? What's that in the background? Is that our world?
Is that what?
Is that your... There's something screaming in the background.
Yeah, I think it's on the street.
Oh, okay. Most of them were monosyllables and many were commands. The idea, it would seem, was to reflect the bombardment with words that surround us constantly. And this worked for a time. But then it began to be a bore. Now, that's what we're talking about. It becomes a bore until you find something that you identify with in it, right?
Right.
And he didn't find any. It's just funny the way this bombardment, when you look at just even the 19th century, the bombardment of information on people, public information in the cities, that to point out the bombardment was odd. You know, just think of the bombardment by 1950, radio, movies, magazines, and cars and everything. But nobody, people are going around with literate identities, and they're just seeing order. You know what I mean? Because they can only see the printed page. They just look at what's linear. They're not conditioned to notice the chaos. They suppress it. Okay. Meantime, the tape was emitting a continuous, nerve-wracking, monotonous, relentless spew of noise. I think that's the feedback, I guess, right?
Yeah.
He calls it a relentless spew of noise. Presumably, the conversation of the people around the tables was part of this, but not a word could one distinguish in the general uproar. So he's really thrown by the feedback. This is a record of someone who's never experienced feedback and thinks that maybe you intend it. He's not sure, you know?
Yeah.
And he says, why would you intend chaos? He can see the visual bombardment. And see, that's relevant, but he doesn't know that we actually live in total feedback chaos all the time in a city.
Just today I got an email with a lot of stuff from my buddy Ralph Abraham about his experiences in Japan, which I think he just got back from, with the conference on chaos theory.
Yeah. What did he say about it? Is he aware
well,
that?
I mean, you know, Ralph created the first real equations of chaos theory
at Santa Cruz, right? Santa Barbara,
right,
or Santa Cruz?
Yeah, at Santa Cruz. He's still there.
Yeah.
But now the kind of resurgence of interest in chaos theory is mostly in Asia. Parts of Europe, but not very much anymore in the United States.
Is it because they're 20 years behind technologically and culturally?
In a way.
Yeah. Do you feel that when you're in Germany presenting these shows that they never experienced any of this 20, 50, 40 years ago, and they are now...
There were some people, you know, and I know who they were. But it certainly wasn't part of the popular culture.
For them, yeah.
Yeah, for them. And now they're interested in it historically, which is...
But that could mean they're interested in because they see it in the present. And they're saying, oh, these guys are pointing to what we can notice now.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Also, you know, Europe is much more a classical...
Yeah.
Environment for culture than the United States.
And when we mean classical, McLuhan would say that's a mixture of senses. They're more tactile, more multisensory, traditionally, but they do represent the eye bias, whereas America is more industrial and kinetic. That's why the classical European culture thinks Americans are not intellectual. They're not book-oriented as much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but, you know, somehow they are very drawn to American art, American drama, American literature, you know. It's a big deal in Europe.
But that's because they're fascinated by what they call the other.
They're
fascinated by this weird kinetic culture.
And aren't
Americans fascinated, you know, since Henry Miller's Daisy Miller novels, about Americans are fascinated about the high culture of Europe, which includes the avant-garde of Europe. I mean, it's the same, they're the other for us. I mean, that's the way it's been through the 20th century. Now it's all mixed up, right? It's a different cultural tone for the whole planet because they're all in the discarnate cyberspace. But institutions need to get a handle on the cultural linear history, so they're interested in what you guys did because they see that relevant somehow to the Americanization of their culture. I mean, they've got a lot of Americanizing going on, right?
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Okay, so the it talks about... Oh, I just want to say, I looked up shortwave. The first successful transatlantic tests were conducted by radio amateurs in December 1921, operating in the 200-meter medium wave band, the shortest wavelength then available to amateurs. In 1922, hundreds of North American amateurs were heard in Europe at 200 meters, and at least 20 North American amateurs heard amateur signals from Europe. Now, see, that's 1922. That's when Joy starts thinking of sending his wake, late 1922.
Yeah, well, it all fits together, don't it?
Yeah, so basically it's a 20s phenomenon.
I grasped a little phrase this weekend, inspired by desire.
Yeah. I think of Dylan's album, mid-70s, called Desire, but Desire is a big POMO theme, postmodern theme, through the 60s, 70s, 80s. So inspired by desire...
Well, it came out of a conversation about the difference between want and need.
Want and need.
Yes.
Yeah.
I said the thing that links the two more than anything is desire.
Right, and Krishnamurti talks about thought comes from desire, or desire comes from thought. He talks about that interplay, you know, the tactility, the ambivalence of which is which. You could say mind-body. All creation comes from desire, but desire comes from thought. You know that paradox?
Uh-huh.
So inspired by desire, inspired by thought,
yeah.
which is inspired by images. Which is the vortex of sensation that a baby experiences.
And also the Remy Dugourmand's line, the idea is merely a worn-out image.
Yeah, Dugourmand, G-O-U-R-M-O-N-T, right?
Right.
I know McLuhan would quote him occasionally. But the baby, the infant, when born into the vortex of sensory... overload, has to start sorting out and doing this. So, and thinking and desiring and being impinged by suggestion from the parents and the environment.
Yep.
It's always a mixture. It's interesting, McLuhan, I was thinking of this earlier when I was wondering about what to say to you or what to talk about. McLuhan was asked on a popular TV show in Canada, what is art today? And he said, and this is about 1971-70, he says, mixed media. Now, mixed media is always what is, I mean, speaking and dancing 10,000 years ago is mixed media. But mixed media had a particular 1960s meaning, and he's talking about what you were known for, mixed media.
Right.
So he's actually saying, when they said, what's art today? Well, Gert Stern or Usko. Even though
well,
there were...
I mean, he, you know, his famous line about he was really a Victorian, which
yeah.
I always thought was a kind of, he was indicating a kind of a retrogressive part of himself, because he was about as much a Victorian as...
That's right. No, he
as he was a space traveler.
No. He was doing a Wyndham Lewis. Whoever he would be, he's a contrarian, but he did it very subtly and almost formally and friendly. But mixed media on his, if you say art, like in galleries,
yeah,
that's mixed media. But McLuhan also meant what he was doing.
Absolutely, because he thought of mixed media rather than multimedia.
That's right, and he thought of the computer globally used as a thermostat to modulate whole populations, so you'd have 6 months of TV in Venezuela, and then you turn it off, and then you give them just newspapers. You know, that whole scenario he laid out in his Playboy interview, that was the big level that he was thinking on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's where he was a space traveler or a satellite conductor, looking at the whole planet and modulating these environments. Way bigger vision than Bucky Fuller's world game vision. Bucky was just talking about old hardware resources and a bit of new housing or something. You know what I mean?
And in a sense, a lot more realistic than
Bucky.
Timothy Leary's ideas of what the future would be like.
That's right, and so we know now, and you have Andrew Christie doing this great PhD, and Schelke, an art critic, and a Dutch art critic, she's recognizing the importance of McLuhan in the art debates that people don't recognize. The point is, you can see that he was the one who had the big picture really crystal clear and was not hypnotized by the big picture. He knew the services and disservices. And so 40 years later, Michael was talking about, we didn't totally get what McLuhan was saying, you know, the other part that McLuhan was warning about. And that's why you miss him. You would like to hear what he had to say about all this, right?
It would really be fascinating, because I don't see the people coming out of McLuhan. Now, I just got a message today from Paul Ryan. You remember Paul?
Yes, and you talk about, I'm reading something, you call it Ryan something. I know you're referring to Paul Ryan, but I don't know where I read it. But yeah, you were talking.
This is the tripartite thing. But he says to me, please join me at a small private party to celebrate the acquisition of my papers, 1943 to 2008. And selected videotapes by the Archive of American Art, Smithsonian Institute.
Yeah, and we've talked about him. He was at the Fordham meeting in 68.
Yeah, what?
And I know Paul. I've been to his place, talked to him. But he's a Batesonite now, and I never thought that he's an ecologist. He's into remembering nature, first nature. And to me...
Well, yes, in a sense, and he's always been interested... Particularly in water phenomenon and video.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
But you started off saying the people coming out of McLuhan don't have the range or span or toughness of the original McLuhan. And to me, Paul Ryan is one of those types, that none of these people are anywhere near what McLuhan was dealing with. And are
Paul,
you saying you agree with me?
I think Paul has been influenced a lot by Marshall, but he's also been influenced by a lot of other people.
Yeah, Bateson. Bateson's a big one.
I was just going to say Bateson, and also all of the French...
the postmodern guys?
Yes.
I guess Deleuze and Guattari.
Yeah, all of
Foucault.
Those. And particularly the American philosopher... Pierce.
Yeah, from 100 or more years ago, yes. I mean, I've read Paul's book, forget the title of it, Video Something, Video Code, Video Brain, Video Something, and I've gone through his thesis and the Klein bottle. And That's what it was. I was listening to something you said about the Klein bottle, and then you said the Ryan pod.
The Ryan tube, yeah. It's a three, in other words, you've got the Mibi strip, the Klein bottle, and then he's developed a third interface figure,
yeah,
which he uses as a therapeutic tool.
For himself or for clients?
No, for three-party interactions.
In a therapeutic context, or?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
This is what McClure would say. He'd have no problem. He says, people use my ideas in any walks of life or things they do. You know, that's no problem what Paul does. They're adapting it to their concerns.
Paul, Paul comes out of the intersection of Marshall's Catholicism with John Culkin, and,
he was a priest. He was going to be a priest.
Right.
And then he left the priesthood and became an ecologist.
And, Paul was a friar.
Friar, right, yeah.
Right.
And he was I think he met Matthew Fox. I think he told me he met Matthew Fox or one of those radical guys in the seminary or wherever they were, in 64 or 65. You know Matthew Fox? He's the radical theologian who got excommunicated. It was no way it could have been Tired de Chardin. Could it have been de Chardin that Paul met? Could he have been in a New York State seminary? I'm not sure. It was some guy who really had a big influence on him and radicalized Paul. And then he heard, guess what? He heard, I think, on WBAI, a Marshall McLuhan speech in audio recording in 66. I'm assuming it would be something like WBAI. Maybe it was on some other network. But then he said, who's this guy? And then he went into looking into McLuhan, and then he met Carpenter, and then he was on the board of the Fordham gang doing the starting Media Ecology.
Yeah.
And then
he was part of... He was at Fordham during that time, right?
Yeah, he was I don't know if he called staff, but he was part of the gang there and working regularly.
Yeah.
He was like an assistant maybe to Ted Carpenter.
That's where I first met him.
Yeah. And what happened is that we mentioned Harold Channer earlier. Paul ends up in the New Paltz area doing video on the TV up there, and that's where Channer and them were first broadcasting. And then he did an ecological structure up there. He studied the rivers, and he... What's that word? He begins with C-H, the K-O-R-D, the cord, the cot, some kind of term that he notices in the way the water moves. I can't remember.
I can't either.
But that's a concept he develops in his book. But so here he is, his papers, somebody has recognized them.
Right.
Smithsonian. Jeez.
Yeah.
Another famous person that, or valuable cultural person that Gerd Stern knew, right?
Well, the party's on October 2nd, so of course I'm going to try and go, although I've got another thing. I've got the monthly poetry science thing the same night.
Right. Now, you say October 2nd. That date was prominent in my mind today because that's the date that Heinz Förster died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, October 2nd, 2002. And I was thinking, that's pretty close to Gerd's birthday, so I think about numbers that way. So this is the reason I was thinking about it. It's Paul's day. And he would have read or known about Förster and all that, right? He studied that kind of stuff.
Sure, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's talking, so the reviewer is talking about but then it began to be a bore. Meantime, the tape was emitting... Okay, there's the feedback. Presumably, the conversation with people around the tables was part of this, but not a word could one distinguish in the general uproar. So he's looking for, just as you look for signs, image you can identify with, he's looking for words, verbal words, that he can identify with. That's left hemisphere thinking, and he doesn't recognize the right hemisphere environment around him.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason he was sent to the...
review.
That evening when he didn't want to go... was because there were all these important people.
Like the mayor.
And there were 16 people on stage, in these groups of four.
Well, that was good, and clever marketing. You put these famous people in this. That'll get attention.
And he wanted to hear what they had to say to each other.
Very good. Now, did you, were you...
I actually had wanted people to hear what they all said to each other. But, of course, you know, all at the same time, simultaneously. So I knew it was going to be kind of a mix, but I didn't know it was going to be, you know, a mix of feedback as well as verbology.
Yeah, you did not know you were going to create a Stravinskian scale of effects.
Yes, exactly.
But you were thinking of Mark. You said, okay, great, these people are coming. That'll attract a little attention. You know, that's a marketing ploy you came up with.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And they went along with it for some reason. Why did the mayor come?
Hey, you know...
You're persuasive, or did someone else persuade?
I know it was Judith McBean who...
Oh, yeah, you had the right social doyen to... had the connections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one to another. Like if the mayor knows Herb Cain is coming, and if Herb Cain knows the mayor is coming, and if Jeremy Atkins knows, you know, it
spiraled like feedback.
Spiraled
like feedback on the anthropomorphic level, the human level. So the thing is, I had a thought there that you're sort of intuiting the celebrity culture. No, that's not what I want to say. In the 50s, you made the contacts that allowed you, like Herb Cain, to then come back.
Herb was a good friend of mine. There was no doubt that he was going to come.
But see, your high society connections 5 years earlier allowed you to pull this off. I mean,
that's true.
And this review is being written on November 13th, in between the shows, Tuesday, which is three shows, Tuesday the 12th?
Just two.
Oh, and none on the 13th, and the second one on the 14th. Okay. So so there was a day break between this.
I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, on the program it says Thursday, November 12th, dash Thursday, November 14th.
Okay.
It says two performances, yeah. So you have a break on the 13th.
Yeah. Okay.
And if anybody's wondering why we're going into detail about here, and you know, I think it's an important, and we're showing it through our conversation with you, this was an important event in terms of the effects of having your first public feedback, right? I mean, has any art historian gone into this like we're going into?
No, I don't think so.
You probably, in the Bancroft thing, there's detail, but we're going into we're relating it to McLuhan and the themes of what's going on in the culture.
Right.
So, he says, this went on for 40 minutes. My God, 40 minutes. And then there was an intermission. After the intermission, the same thing started all over again. That's incredible. With some of the same slides and the same noise. My God, Gerd, what were you thinking? You repeated yourself. This time, the audience revolted. Now, there's the linear thinking. You got to have new content after the intermission, right? The shock of repeating the same environment. There were catcalls, stamping, and whistling. Now, do you remember that?
Yeah.
And were you excited that was happening?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the anarchist in you loved this, right?
Uh-huh.
Your inner anarchist. A young man went to the piano and played chopsticks. You know who that was?
No, some guy from the audience, right?
Okay, both he played it both straight and in tone clusters. Well, that's interesting. He mixed it. That person playing the piano mixed the straight, the linear, the order, and then the chaos. Like Cecil Taylor, isn't that Cecil Taylor? Tone clusters.
Maybe.
As if to say the whole thing was infantile and an insult to the public intelligence. To the public intelligence. And no critic ever said it better. He's saying that chopsticks was the best critical response. You see, that person within the feedback retrieved their initial childlike piano training, right? And evoked that, but then threw in the avant-garde, more mature piano player. So the guy was miming. It wasn't an insult. He was miming what was going on.
He was trying to become part of the act.
Yeah, and it's the entropy, the fine line between order and chaos that Joyce was doing in Finding His Wake. And, of course, everybody thought Joyce was nuts when Finding His Wake was serialized as work in progress from the mid-20s into the 30s. They thought that he had gone nuts, you know. Nobody liked Finding His Wake as it was unfolded. And, okay, for a moment, it seemed as if a serious riot... There's your Stravinsky thing. Serious riot might take place. But then the good nature of the crowd asserted itself, and after a while, it was all over.
he eliminated the fact that we stopped the piano by Michael McClure and I got up on stage and started reading or voicing beast poetry. You know that Michael wrote rah.
The beast poetry.
Yeah, and we screamed it out loud, and it drowned out the piano, and then the guy got up and went back into the audience. There was a lot happening.
Well, you did that intentionally.
Yes.
That was your...
No, it wasn't part of the program. Actually, Michael suggested it. He said, let's get up there and...
Encounter this guy.
Yeah.
And also the
stuff that was coming out of the audience.
Okay, and you had a microphone to do it on.
Yes.
Now, what do you think of the idea of the good nature of the crowd asserted itself? Well, what's that mean?
I don't know. I mean,
they got bored, so bored they didn't care and they stopped rioting, or they got it in some way, or they started maybe.
Well, I think the cat calling or something was in reference to something that was going on, but I can't remember what it was.
Well, what's interesting, you're dealing with this, compared to a punk rock concert or a mosh pit, you know, 20 years later, this is a sedate crowd, you know.
Yeah,
these
really
are literate, sophisticated people. Maybe, well, the first night would be more high society people or educated people than the second. Okay, but the second night, the Oi Polloi came out, right? It was all kinds of classes of people, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what happened there? Did the second night have a potential riot?
No.
People had read this. They knew what to expect. And
the second night we had less feedback.
Oh, okay. So they could hear what the people
It was a lot. It was a lot more legible.
Okay.
We recorded some of it, which we have a recording of some of it.
Of what the professors and Ginsberg and what they were saying.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So it was, okay, so...
I'm not even sure that they were... It wasn't the same 16 people.
Now, okay. Now, the thing is that this is a puny little event in a little room compared to...
It's not a little room, it's a big room.
Oh, okay, but it's in a little... it's in a museum, okay. The point is, just think of what's going on at the same time. Kennedy is planning to go to Dallas. Nobody knows this, but somebody's conspiring to sabotage him. The Beatles are rising in England and are going to come to America pretty soon. You've got all the pop culture that everybody's into. Andy Warhol is surfacing. It's only in retrospect, within the linear history of art, that we put symbolic meaning in this event. You know what I mean? And that's the last 10 years. You've been going around as people symbolically recognize what USCO did within the little world of art. But little world, it is a big world for sales. I mean, you read any Village Voice art criticism over the last 3 years. It was incredible what went on in the art world this decade, where people were taken out of graduate school and made. And promoted immediately, and there was lots of money around by whoever bought it to the guy made a lot of money.
I haven't noticed it myself.
Well, you're not in the art commercial market world, but it was booming. Okay, now that's another point. In your world, you're not noticing it. Even great successes like today, someone pointed out on my website that Damien Hirst just made the biggest sale in history, like $200 million. On a show. Did you hear about that?
No.